Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and very warm Christmas greetings to all of our listeners. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, this Christmas season, we remember those in the armed forces, many far from home. What Catholic chaplains are doing to heal and comfort veterans and families. And one of the fiercest World War II battles was fought at Christmas in Italy. How former enemies finally make peace. A living hell, far from home, shell-shocked and under fire. The life of a soldier on the battlefield or the officer struggling to keep the peace on the Green Line is a lonely one, full of the unknown, of death, injury, and raw fear. Will I ever see my family again? Where, amidst this hell, can there be a God? These are but just some of the pressing anxieties and questions members of the armed forces must live with at war, and two, the living phantoms of their fears and horrific experiences that continue to haunt them upon their return home. Often, many in the armed forces turn to their chaplains, seeking answers to life's most difficult and existential questions. Queries like, what happened to the merciful, the loving, and forgiving God we've come to know? Why has God forsaken us? Even those who don't believe turn to chaplains, hoping for a word of comfort, encouragement, and support.
We've got chaplains in the three services, the Navy, the Army, and the Royal Air Force here.
Bishop Richard Moth heads the Catholic chaplaincy for the armed forces in Britain. He told Lydia O'Kane, it's a humbling job.
And I'm bishop for all of those, and also bishop for Catholic personnel and their families, wherever they are in the world. So I have a diocese with no boundaries, really. We've got numbers of chaplains. We could always do with a few more, but any bishop in any diocese will say the better that about his numbers of priests. So I think in terms of encouraging the chaplains that we have at the moment, I'm meeting with them. I'm seeking opportunities as time goes along to meet with them individually, to pray with them, to visit where they are. So I'm getting around to see people and to meet with chaplains and those whom they serve. And, you know, that's certainly going to be a kind of continuing, pretty much non-stop program. So it's very much one of presence and support. I mean, I think combat challenges faith in many ways, obviously. It brings about questions in people's minds. Some people, and you know, looking back through history, one sees this, some people have found faith in war, and for others it's had the reverse effect. It's made faith very difficult for them. And I think to have a chaplain there when you're looking at those questions, when you're facing death in the face, is really very, very important. And I know that our chaplains are playing a very key role in the whole business of care of casualties. They're there with them in the hospitals, very much part of the team in the medical sphere, and that presence is appreciated not just by the casualties but by the staff too. And even if you have a soldier who or a service person who doesn't have a particular faith, the chaplain is somebody who's kind of aside from the chain of command, to whom they can turn, and that's valued too. So the chaplain's role in the armed services is a very broad one, and very significant for the people that he serves.
You're dealing with so many different things. It's very diverse. You're dealing with grief, bereavement. You're dealing with counselling. You're dealing with prayer. You're dealing with there's an awful lot rolled into one in that role, and therefore the chaplain has to adapt to dealing with all of these kinds of issues.
That's right. Yes, and of course he's got his own training as a priest and experience. In a diocese before he comes to the bishopric of the forces, and then you add to that the training that he does in the Navy, Royal Air Force or Army to enable him to fulfill a role in that setting. So the level of training is high, and you know he's with his ship or his squadron or his brigade or regiment or wherever he's posted, and he works with them and trains with them, so he becomes one of the family in that sense, someone that is known to everyone, and really has a place at the heart of things. So I think we must also bear in mind, and I would certainly ask all your listeners to pray especially or specifically at some point for the chaplains, because they need a lot of support in their role too. And they're with people in these difficult circumstances, they're absorbing a lot. And the support of people's prayer in their work is really important to them.
These prayers give the chaplains new strength to combat the doubts and reinforce the faith of their conflict-hardened flock. Such prayers, in a sense, have been institutionalized in national days to remember war veterans and those who have fallen in conflict. To mark the end of World War I at the 11th hour of the 11th month in 1918, many countries established an Armistice Day, a special national holiday to remember their war dead and veterans. In the U.S., it's called Veterans Day. In the UK, it's Remembrance Day. It's important that a nation stand behind its troops and support them in prayer, says Bishop Moth. And those Remembrance Days help remind us of the causes and injustices of war so that future generations will not repeat the errors of their predecessors.
It's important to recognize sacrifice. The sacrifice of others. And if we think about it in civil life, there are lots of different ways in which people recognize the sacrifice of people in other contexts. But I think with Remembrance Sunday, we're remembering obviously those who've died in warfare at the defense of their country and their loved ones. And I think it's important for us to continue to do that so that people can learn the lessons of history, really, and also to pray for those who've died and for their families. But also, we remember the Second World War, and of course, the conflicts since as well. So many of our armed forces, men and women, are serving abroad. Families are being affected by that.
Because when you think of generations now, you kind of think, gosh, do they remember the past or do they want to remember the past? But from what you're saying, it seems like people really still do.
I think they do. I mean, you very often find groups of young people will go, for instance, to the Normandy beaches or the battlefields of the Western Front from the First War, and they're very moved by that experience. For young people to see large numbers of gravestones of young men and women of their own age is a very poignant experience, and I think it does enable them to realize the sacrifice of others. I think that will always continue. But in terms of the present situation, you know, we've got families who have loved ones serving overseas. We've got families who very sadly have experienced the loss of loved ones right now. You know, we're reading about it in the papers daily, and getting news back from Afghanistan about it all the time. And that does heighten people's awareness, and it heightens their need for prayer and the concern of others. tragic events for the families and for their countries. They do kind of, I think, bring home to people the need for reflection, for prayer, for turning to God at these times to seek aid and consolation and a deepening of faith.
For many, this deepening of the faith is repeated each year in our Christian feasts, holidays like Christmas and Easter, which remind us so intimately of Christ's birth and resurrection. They're the feasts we normally celebrate in the warmth of home and closeness of family and friends. Not so for those on the battlefield.
Every opportunity is made to ensure that serving personnel have the opportunity for prayer, for Mass, for the sacraments, to really celebrate as best they possibly can in the situation they find themselves, to celebrate the birth of the Lord and the Incarnation, the Word made flesh. That, you know, that very fact that God is amongst us, I think is so important for our armed forces to have that realization that wherever we are and whatever the circumstances may be, no matter how grisly they might be, you know, God is there with us in that. And the Incarnation, the celebration of Christmas, obviously speaks to that very strongly, that we don't have a God who is distant, but rather we have a God who was incarnate for us and is with us wherever we are, is a very important line of inquiry, if you like, I think, for our troops, a place where they can feel at home with the Lord.
We're invited to remember and pray for the fallen soldiers in war and their families. We must never forget the veterans, especially those living with the scars of fear and conflict.
It's right that we remember those who've died, but also I would certainly ask everybody to pray for those who are casualties. You know, we're seeing very bad wounding going on, some fairly grisly casualties coming back from theatre. And it's important to pray for them as they face rehabilitation, as they face a very often a very different way of life, living with injury, both physical and psychological too. You know, people find they come back and they find it difficult to talk about what they've seen. We must pray for them and also pray for their families, because families, they are waiting anxiously at home for news of their loved ones. And when they do have relatives who come back, who may be wounded or who are having difficulties coming to terms with their experience, then the forces' families need a lot of prayer and support at this time too.
Bishop Richard Moth of the Chaplaincy for Britain's Armed Forces. It was the Stalingrad of Italy, one of the most brutal battles fought in World War II. During Christmas week 1943, the quaint little Italian hill town of Ortona, overlooking the Adriatic Sea, became the bloody battlefield for German and Canadian troops. Hundreds were never to go home. Ted Griffith was one of the few Canadian soldiers to live to tell the story.
The Canadian Army had many battles in Italy, and some of them were much larger than Ortona, but nothing was quite as vicious as Ortona, for the simple reason that Hitler had ordered the Germans to hold the town.
With his gray-white goatee and plump rosy cheeks, Ted looks more like a jovial Burl Ives come Jack Frost than a survivor of one of World War II's fiercest skirmishes. 1,400 of his Canadian comrades weren't so lucky. They're buried in a well-loved and cared-for cemetery on the Ortona hillside. Just as many, if not more, Germans perished in the streets of Ortona, too. Ted was a tank commander as the Loyal Edmonton Regiment and Seaforth Highlanders joined forces with the Three Rivers Regiment when the most bitter combat broke out between December 20th and December 27th, 1943. What makes his story so compelling is the fact that decades later, Canadian and German veterans of the Ortona Battle were to meet, hug, and cry together, and most importantly, forgive each other in a reunion of reconciliation. As fate would have it, the Catholic chaplain who helped make that memorable event come about never lived to see the day. But let's go back to the beginning of Ted's story, Ortona, Christmas week, 1943.
It had no tactical significance at all as far as the battle was concerned. But as I say, it just grew in intensity because Hitler had ordered the Germans to hold it.
Now, it's been called by many people the Stalingrad of Italy. There was fighting house to house. The houses were booby-trapped. I mean, it must have been a horrific, horrific experience, not just for you soldiers fighting it, but for the civilians themselves.
Yes. The civilians, some had moved out to the countryside. Some of them had moved down into the railway tunnel that was down below the town. But there were quite a number who chose to remain in their homes. And the sad part of it is that the civilian casualties were just as heavy as the military ones. At the moment, the Canadian cemetery at Ortona has 1,375 graves there. The Germans lost more than we did. And the civilians, I believe their losses were approaching 500. You know, for a small town, that is a significant number.
Now, for you as a soldier, it was Christmas time back then. You presumably were very young. I imagine that many of the Canadian, the Allied troops were very young. What was going through your mind? It was your first, probably your first real military experience, too. Did you ever say to yourself, what am I doing here?
We ask that question every day. You know, the significance of Christmas didn't really dawn on us until Christmas Eve, when we had a small dinner in a partially destroyed church. At that time, one of the soldiers got up and played the organ, and we sang a Christmas carol. That was our first sort of conscious thought that it was Christmas. The very next morning is one that I don't care to remember, but I cannot forget it.
Christmas Day.
Christmas Day. The first chore I had that morning was we were fighting in a small piazza on the north side of town, and the Germans had a machine gun set up near the altar in one church, and the machine gun caught the infantry as they moved across the square, and consequently I had to blow in the front of this church. The infantry then went in and took out the Germans that were left. But that was just the beginning of Christmas morning. There was a hospital next door to it, and they had moved all the patients down into the basement. And the Germans had barricaded the hospital, and they had machine guns set up in there. And in the end, I had to destroy the church, or the hospital, as well as the church. And that was my Christmas morning.
What happened to all of those patients in
the basement? The patients were, strangely enough, they all survived. None of them were hurt. They were all in the basement of the hospital. Later in the afternoon, as we gradually cleared the Germans from the square, the line of civilians came out of the hospital, headed by the priest and a little 7-year-old boy behind him, and a number of civilians. They had been all down in the basement of the hospital. And when we went back for our dinner of reconciliation with the Germans in 1998, Angela Arnone brought over a middle-aged man, and she introduced him as the 7-year-old boy who was behind the priest. And of course, he was quite emotional at that point in time when he found out who I was.
But this was the Italian priest of the village.
Yes.
I understand that you had a chaplain with the Canadian troops.
Yes.
And that he actually tried to keep your morale up and
he did indeed.
In very, very difficult situations.
Father Joseph Wilhelm, who later became the Archbishop of Kingston.
In Canada.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. When we... interest in Ortona stems from Father Wilhelm. At a regimental reunion some years ago, we were all sitting around, as old soldiers do, fighting the battles all over again, and all of a sudden the padre said, wouldn't it be a nice idea to go back to Ortona and on Christmas Eve have dinner in the same church that we had Christmas dinner in 1943? And everyone thought it was a great idea, but nothing was done about it. Wasn't until 1998, and sadly the padre had just died at that point in time. We got into the talking about Ortona, and we decided to go see what we could do about getting back there. We came back, and we invited the Germans that we had fought against.
Was that also an idea?
That was the padre's idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was the dinner of reconciliation. And the Germans arrived down, and... we did have Christmas dinner in this church, Christmas Eve dinner, I should say, in the church that we ate in 1943. And we spent a week together with the Germans. Since that time, there has been a great interplay between the veterans of the Germans and ourselves, with messages and telephone calls and faxes and so forth. And... when I came down to Ortona for the opening of the museum, the Germans came down again as well. So,
but that must have been a very emotional moment for you and
it
your,
was
your
indeed
colleagues.
For all of us.
Especially that Christmas dinner in the church.
That's right.
What did you feel? You were face to face with the men who were holding up guns and tank barrels at you in the Ortona War. What was going through your mind?
Frankly, we took them for what they were, which was soldiers fighting for their country, forgetting the iniquities of the German system at that time. These people were good, clean, fair fighters. They were none of the SS groups that were pretty nasty in all, but this group of Germans from the parachute division were the elite, and they were extremely capable. They fought very hard, and they fought fairly. And there was none of this business of shooting prisoners and so forth that you found with the SS. We found that meeting these people, I think, is best exemplified by Karl Barlein, who was a pioneer, an engineer with the parachute division. He was the man who set the charge and blew the house in which 27 men from the Loyal Edmonton Regiment were killed. And in 1998, at this reconciliation dinner, Barlein said to me, "Sir, I had to come. I had to come and face the men from the Loyal Edmonton Regiment." He said, "I have carried this around all my life." And he said, "I have to face them," which he did. And I'm very pleased to say the people from the Loyal Edmonton Regiment accepted him for what he was, a professional soldier.
Was there any talk of forgiveness at that time?
Yes, there was. It was the dispelling of ghosts of Ortona. We found that the Germans carried as many ghosts around as we did. And we fell together as I say, two groups of soldiers recognizing the professional competence of each other, which was extremely emotional. And the tears were flowing down the cheeks of the veterans, both on the German side and our side.
Killing must be something I can't even imagine what one must experience.
Yes, it's
pointing a gun at someone else and then seeing that person fall in front of you.
It's a very nasty business. But the sad part of it is, in war, you become desensitized because every day is the same. The sight of bodies is always present on a battlefield.
You said that both you and your comrades and the German soldiers, for all these years, have been carrying around ghosts.
That's right.
How did that experience, you were also in another war, in the Korean War, how did those experiences change you, do you think?
Well, one ghost that I have carried around, I never thought that I could ever speak of it, and it wasn't really until we got together and started comparing experiences. I was detailed one night, on Christmas Eve night actually, after this dinner, to go up and talk with the infantry platoon commander that I would be supporting in the morning. I went up this dark street and I didn't have the faintest idea where I was. I was looking for him, but I didn't see him. And just by a corner, I stopped trying to orient myself, and I heard some footsteps. And I didn't know where I was for sure. I didn't want to pull my revolver, so I took a commando knife, which I carried, and as this figure approaching came around the corner, I saw the anodized belt buckle that he had, which showed he was a German. I leaned forward very quickly with the knife and gutted him like a fish. And he never uttered a sound, and he fell down against the wall. And I remembered that for the next two or three days, I passed the body a number of times as we moved forward, back and forth. And one day, out of curiosity, I stopped and went through his pockets. And I got his paybook, which showed he hadn't quite reached his 17th birthday. Now that is a ghost I've carried for many, many years. And as I say, it's only been since 1998 reconciling with the Germans and talking things over with our lads who went through the same thing that I've ever been able to bring this out. I've always carted it around.
How many other war veterans from World War II, or any other war for that matter, have been carting their ghosts around with them for years? Perhaps old enemies should consider reconciliation. A pretty darn good ghostbuster, if you ask me. And my thanks again to Ted Griffith, Canadian tank commander in the Ortona battle. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.